Ask almost any youngster coming out of a fireworks tent what day it is, and what you'll hear is, "It's the 4th of July, man. Where have you been?" What you are not likely to hear is the actual name of this holiday on your calendar, Independence Day, which is not too surprising because the original meaning of several of our holidays has been lost in the hoopla of celebrating them. It seems the mood in America is not quite as optimistic this year as it has been, a fact summed up rather tersely by a bumper sticker I saw last week: "God bless America, but please hurry." Most of us, however, are inveterate optimists. It's part of the American character, I think. Somebody asked a man the other day how it was living in Washington, D.C. right now, and he answered with a story. He told how it was once standard procedure in wartime to have a runner who moved along with the platoons gathering intelligence, and how on one occasion this particular runner came back to report to the company commander. Well, the officer said to him, "How does it look?" And the runner, an unrelenting optimist, replied enthusiastically, "We can attack in any direction, sir. We're surrounded." The next time July the 4th falls on a Sunday, there will be only 6 months left of the century in which we've all spent our lives. In 1999, July the 4th will happen again on a Sunday. I hope, by God's grace, to celebrate that day too, and to coast at least a little distance into the 21st century. But all I'm reasonably sure of is this day and this audience. So let's talk about what today and tomorrow might mean if we looked deeper than the picnics and the firecrackers and the day off work. The flags were flapping in the wind up and down my street last night and this morning. And I know that this weekend, over the sound of bands and barbecues and politicians standing on flatbed trucks in the cemeteries of small towns all over America, the word freedom will ring out over and over. It's a beautiful word, freedom. It speaks the music of the most universal of all human longings. It claims that the hateful wall may stand for nearly 50 years, but it finally comes down. It beckons people with such incredible power that they pay smugglers thousands of dollars to get them across a river or across an ocean to a country where they think freedom lives more gloriously than anywhere else. The problem is that freedom is never absolute. And on a national level or a personal level, we run headlong into trouble if we forget that. We have a song in our congregational hymn book which says in its final line that people committed to the notion of a kingdom of God are firmly bound, forever free. And I want you to hear the oxymoron clearly: firmly bound, forever free. A child's mind asks, how can that be? tied up and yet free. It makes no sense, but it does. And the sermon this morning is built on that paradox. It asks you to consider a proposition I believe in absolutely, that only the bound are free. It's a contradiction in terms that isn't very popular, especially among people under 30. But a paradox has been described as a truth standing on its head to attract attention. So I'm hoping this one will catch your ear and make you consider it for at least a few minutes. One thing to remember is that without limits, the ones you impose on yourself or the ones imposed by others, freedom can be a very risky business. The early church found that out quickly enough. Paul taught his new converts in the Greek city of Corinth that they had been set free from the meticulous and exhausting system known as the old Jewish law, but he had no sooner said it than the abuses began. Some pretty wild stuff went on in that little church, all committed in the mistaken notion that to be free means you can do whatever you like. It was such an exciting idea that Paul even had to get after people who thought that if the grace of God is so freely and fully given, why not sin all the more so that grace can abound? In other words, if you're going to confess on Sunday, you may as well make Saturday night worth it. It wasn't what Paul had in mind exactly. He was wise enough to know that all of us will be slaves to something. Show me, the Roman philosopher Seneca said, somebody who is not a slave. One is a slave to lust, another to greed, a third to ambition, all of us to fear. What freedom probably means in the final analysis is the chance to choose our own form of bondage. Through the late 60s and into the 70s, I watched hundreds of high school and college kids rejoicing in what they mistakenly took for absolute freedom. Society wasn't to restrict them anymore. Professors need not be heeded. Parents were hopelessly old-fashioned. They were free. So some of them turned to drugs and alcohol and entered a slavery worse than anything they had left. The New Testament, as is so often the case, has a picture for that. The old image of the prodigal son swaggering down the highway toward the far country, skipping with joy at the thought of being free at last, money in his pocket, dad's rules receding with every step, his own master, only to learn after a while, as millions of us do, that he has only entered a different form of bondage, that in his case, he is now imprisoned by his own grossest appetites, and when they call, he has to come cowed and obedient. When he finally catches on to that, he knows what most of us find out sooner or later, that life's crucial question is not how much freedom can I guarantee for myself, but in which of life's inevitable bondages can my life best fulfill itself? Have you ever noticed how more and more freedoms open up for people who have put themselves under some form of bondage? Here, for example, are two boys, both free to go to college, and to submit to the discipline of study, or if they choose to go off and do things that are much more fun at the moment. One works hard in school, goes on to a graduate degree, and then another, until today he is free to go anywhere in America to pursue his profession. The other resists the bondage of reading, writing, and hard study, and the world of formal education ends. He is a fine lad with some good qualities the other boy lacks, but he is not free in certain ways he would like. Now he would go back to school, but the past grades are a hindrance, and the graduate record examination looms as an all but impossible barrier. He finds himself not free, but the prisoner of his past. Please listen to me if you are young. When freedom is seen as an escape from obligation, it will always carry a higher price tag than you can imagine, because the freedom you want later on, especially the wonderful freedom to choose your own work, create the life you want, is based on sacrifices made much earlier, based, in other words, on the bondage to which you submitted for freedom's sake. The New England poet Robert Frost understood the paradox we're talking about when he spoke of freedom as moving easy in harness. What can that mean except that we submit gracefully to restraints that make it possible later for us to do something useful? To think of freedom as an escape from limits and obligations is to misunderstand entirely the meaning of that word. Paul said to his Galatian church, "You have been called into freedom, but you are to serve one another in love." Freedom in service. Liberty in bondage. Those are the paradoxes of a noble idea. Try doing anything you like in the name of freedom, and you find yourself in one jail after another. The teenage boy sat across the table in a coffee shop, a radical because he doesn't know quite what else to be, saying with a confident grin, "I just tell everybody I meet what I think of them. One thing about me is I speak my mind. I don't hold back. Whatever I think of someone, I tell them." "And do you have many friends?" I ask. The grin fades. "I guess not really. To tell you the truth, you're the only friend I have." No restrictions on his tongue. None of this silly stuff about courtesy. And sitting there across from me that day, the dawning, painful awareness that he had put himself into a prison of loneliness. Thomas Huxley said a long time ago that our worst difficulties begin when we are able to do as we please, because then we have to decide what we please to do. And this is why many of us can only vacation for so long, and then we have to get back under discipline. Some of you in this room found out when you retired that the bondage of your work set you free in ways you had not realized. That's why every great religion in the world teaches that we are made for mastery, that we are not fulfilled until we become the slave of some great loyalty, captured so thoroughly by a cause or an idea that it carries us outside the prison of self and frees us to fulfill ourselves. A French philosopher was right. To be free means free to choose whose slave I want to be. Ernest Camel, who for years was minister of the Riverside Church in Manhattan, spoke at a conference I attended in Pittsburgh a few years ago. He said that when he took early retirement from full-time ministry, it was so he could do some freelance writing. And then he made a painful discovery, namely that without the deadline hanging over his head, without the due dates, without the compulsion to finish something at a specified time, he could not make himself work hard enough. Obligation creates compulsion, and often compulsion drives creativity. We do what we did not think ourselves capable of doing because we have to. Two or three colleagues of mine in seminary, searching frantically for excuses to avoid sweating over a sermon manuscript, said they would just let the Spirit move them when they got into the pulpit. My preaching professor warned them. He said, "Boys, if you want to be sure the Spirit fills your preaching on Sunday, my advice would be to invite the Spirit into your study during the week when the two of you can spend time together alone." I am free to speak to you this morning without utter foolishness, only if I have been bound all week. But there are many things I'm not free to do this morning. There is a reason why I am not free to play the piano like Patrick Jones. I did not spend the necessary years in bondage. Pat would say just as quickly that he's not free to do genetic research in a great university because that wasn't the bondage he chose. Nothing of permanence or meaning comes to anyone in life until first that person finds a discipline under which to work. And it's what Jesus meant when he said another paradoxical thing, "Take my yoke upon you, and you will find rest to your soul." How strange that an object of labor should stand in the same sentence for rest. His yoke is Robert Frost's harness, and Christ openly admits that it will be a burden, but the kind of burden that ultimately sets us free. I have a chance to watch all sorts of parents in action when we have rehearsals and weddings in this room. I'm talking only now of non-members. So don't try to identify anyone. But some of these parents obviously think they are free to sidestep the unpleasant aspects of child rearing and still be successful parents, but it's obvious that they are failing. They wheedle and cajole. They plead with an unruly child. They bribe until they run out of gifts and ask me if I have any peppermints. They set no limits for fear their child will not love them. And all the while their child is miserable and desperately in search of boundaries that are easily identifiable. I am convinced that parents whose first priority is to keep their kids from being mad at them or ever feeling frustrated are likely to find that they have offered more liberty than their kids can handle, and they have put personality handcuffs on them. But that's only one man's opinion about a very complex subject. We cherish freedom in congregational churches, and we talk about it a lot, but there is a risk in that too. For some people, it means no harness, no burden, no sacrifice. Religion as a rest stop for 1 hour a week and no cost the rest of the time. I can tell you about a man who at the very least knew better than that. He used to come to church where I preached in St. Louis, sit in the very back and look intent, but very skeptical. He would leave the sanctuary quickly after the sermon, never bothering to speak to anyone. And some of our people felt that he thought church was a kind of charade, a bit of a joke at which he could smile. And then one day he stopped by my office to say to me that he had been considering Christianity. I was thinking he probably didn't even know what it was. When he began telling me, in 15 minutes, he described the meaning of the cross and the mission of Christ and the essence of that bright dream which Christ called the kingdom of heaven as completely and accurately and with as much sensitivity as anyone I have ever heard outside a seminary. Your understanding is remarkable, I told him. So what's the problem? He paused for a moment and said, I understand it, all right. I just can't do it. I know what Christians are supposed to be, and I can't be one. I was impressed by his honesty. No cheap notions about easy freedom. He understood that only the bound are free, and he wasn't sure yet that he was up to the binding. I know one thing. If he ever decided to commit himself to a church, it would be a lucky church. As we are, to have you.